behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I am Ben. You are you. As always, we are joined by our illustrious super producer, Noel Sherlock Brown.
Sherlock's good. Yeah, I think that's one we maybe have not used yet because, you know, this is another edition of one of our mystery episodes where you don't know what I'm going to ask you, and we're going to do it a little different this time.
Right.
You are also going to ask me a question or have a topic that I don't know about as well. So we're going to do two in one here. And there's some precedent for this. We've done this 8 times already. I've looked up all the dates and times we've done this, and it started back in June of last year and went all the way through September, but we haven't done one since then.
Mm-hmm.
This will be our 9th, and I guess 9th and 10th if you want to count it. You want to be legit about it, I suppose.
Sure.
9th and 10th topics or mystery topics.
It's a double feature.
A double feature. That's the best way to put it, maybe. So I guess since we're going to try to cram 2 into this one, maybe we should just jump right in with my question to you. And I hope it spawns some thought among listeners, you know, that they might write in with some responses to this as well.
All right.
So here's my question.
Shoot.
Should you ever buy a base model car? Not have you ever, not could you, but should you ever buy a base model car? Now, this applies to new and used, so think about it in a lot of different ways.
Here's
what got me thinking about this.
Okay.
My wife's vehicle, that Jeep Renegade that she's got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a scarcity of options and features on that thing. It's a base model vehicle. It's the lowest level Jeep Renegade you can get. And the problem with that is that we're seeing, or at least I'm seeing, the worst version of that car that they can possibly make, really. I mean, it's not great. There's a lot. I've complained about this vehicle several times, and, you know, the whole process of going through to get this and why she got it. She wanted a low monthly payment, and you know, fine, you achieve that. But now you've got a car that's maybe something that you didn't expect it would be. I mean, it's nice when you're there on the lot. It's nice when you look at it compared to whatever you're trading in. But later on, you might have some regrets, some buyer's remorse in this thing that you've bought that versus, you know, paying a few extra dollars more and getting a trim level higher that is a little bit more comfortable in some way, whatever way that would be. Now, things that you can typically expect in a base model car, you can expect things like cloth seats. Now, that used to be vinyl seats back in the day.
Yep, yep.
But cloth seats, you can expect steel wheels, very plain steel wheels, as a matter of fact. No hubcaps. You can expect no window tint, no floor mats in some cases, like in my wife's case. No sunroof, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Some cases, drum brakes on the vehicle. I mean, there's still vehicles that have drum brakes in the rear that are made here in the United States. That's the Honda Fit is one of those vehicles. You might have the fog light delete plastic cap that goes on the front. You know, where there's supposed to be fog lights and they just put a plastic cap there. And you can tell that they're supposed to be there, but they're not there.
And your dash console is going to look weird.
Did you know that for a long time in the Smart for 2 model, the most base Smart for 2 that you get, I think it was called the Pure, and I don't know how long this applied because now they've changed it, but for a while you could get those with no AC and no radio. That was an option in those cars. Can you imagine a no AC, no radio car in, let's say it was 2013?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. So there's a lot of things that you do and don't get with a base model car, and what you do get, I guess, would be a low payment. That's about the only benefit, really, I see. There's a lot of articles on this, and a couple of things. You know, there's some interesting things that were written by Jalopnik about this, and one from Auto Trader, another one from Yahoo Autos.
Mm-hmm.
Before I get into this too far, do you have kind of a general opinion about base model cars, Ben? Do you support this idea? Because there's some people that say that's the way to go. You get a base model car because you get in the door that way. You get whatever it is, and then you can upgrade it as you want. You can add on, but do it on your own, not at the dealership.
I see that, but that's kind of a broad brush to paint with, don't you think? Because there are some things that are going to be more of a hassle to do aftermarket than they would be just, you know, to get it done right from the factory.
Exactly.
So it's strange because base model stuff has evolved over the past few years, especially the past few years, but overall for decades. You know, like once upon a time, of course, we know, and listeners, some of us may be old enough to remember when AC was a fancy option, you know?
Oh, yeah. I've had cars without AC, of course, because whoever bought the car new just simply didn't check that box. And, you know, years later when I'm buying it used, I'm not so concerned about that as I am about the price of the vehicle, and I want something that's economical or whatever.
Yeah.
And I ended up in that vehicle, but then I'm sitting there sweating thinking, like, why didn't they check that box? Why didn't they get AC in this car? Because I'd like it now. I sure would like it. But I knew up front that it didn't have it when I bought it, so it's kind of my fault as well. I mean, that gets passed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's some interesting things like that that you got to consider, though. You know, trim options, I guess, in cars. You know, that's the thing is, like, there's always going to be, you know, not always, not every time, but there's always going to be maybe, I keep saying always, maybe sometimes.
There's often.
Often. There are two or three other options, or
four
options, or maybe even more than that. You know, you can go up to different trim levels, and that offers different, you know, standard packages.
You know what used to irritate me when I was far too young to buy any high value thing like a laptop or a car or stuff like that? What used to irritate me as a kid was seeing varying pricing options for different versions of the same product, and then thinking to myself, "Well, don't make me feel inferior. Buying the lowest, just only sell the best one. Why can't you sell just the best one?
Yeah, just sell the GT model. Don't sell anything else.
Right.
Just give me the GT."
Which obviously that's not going to work.
The problem is when it's brand new, getting that GT option in the car might be another $10,000 or $12,000 or more, depending on what they offer.
Right.
But later, when you sell, okay, there's other thought processes going on later when you're trying to buy a used vehicle, but a new car. Sometimes those options are very, very expensive. Sometimes you can look at it and say, like, well, I don't need a six-speaker sound system. I can add an aftermarket system
for a few hundred dollars. Yeah, that's a great example.
That's a better version than what I would ever get from the factory anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all costs considered, you know, that factory radio is going to be $1,200. I can put one in for $600 and have somebody install it for another $100.
I have a buddy who will do it for beer.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way a lot of people feel about this. So,
with sound system, it makes sense. Okay, here's my thing.
Yeah.
Am I interrupting?
No, go
right
ahead.
So my concept of this relies on the following assumptions. One, it really depends on the specific vehicle we're talking about. Two, the most general thing I can say is that personally, I don't put too much stock in the cosmetic or aesthetic stuff. While I get that it might be nice, for instance, to have the custom metallic gray paint or something like that, for instance, if it doesn't affect the performance of the vehicle, then to me, I don't care as much. They're the basics. Of course, I want a working radio or sound system. Of course, I want AC and a heater.
Yeah, you want comfortable seats. You want air conditioning. You want power windows.
Right, but I don't live in an environment where I need a heated seat. I don't live in an environment or in a lifestyle, really, where I need to have a sunroof. Sunroofs are nice.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be nice to have tinted windows on a car instead of having just, you know, flat, you know, plain glass that's see-through all the way around so you're not, like, driving in a fishbowl all the time?
That's true.
And, you know, it's a safety issue as well.
You used to have some heavy tint on that Honda.
Able to. I do now on my new one, too. I guess you haven't seen it in a while. It looks
no,
pretty
no,
good.
No, I drove by.
Oh, okay. I didn't see you because my windows are so dark. No, but there's something.
But you see what I'm saying?
I totally get it. Anything that's cosmetic, really, is something that you're not particularly interested in paying a premium for.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. So the question is, I mean, there's a bunch of questions here, and I'm going to get to a couple other quick things that I'm going to speed through so we can get onto your topic, too. But another question. In fact, I'm going to have like two or three along the way here. But
Yeah.
So why do manufacturers even offer a base model at all? Why don't they just make one like you said, right?
Oh, the question.
But the idea is, and I think this is so that they can always advertise that starting price.
Yeah.
So they can say,
that,
you know,
MSRP.
Exactly right. They can. So almost everybody ends up spending more money when they get to the dealer to get the nicer version of the same car, you know, like a higher trim level.
Yeah.
Almost everybody does that.
I don't have the numbers, but it seems like buying a base model for a lot of vehicles is relatively rare.
Well, it is, and here's part of the reason. And I know that advertising works like this in a lot of places, and pay attention to this the next time you see it. And I've warned listeners about this before, but when you see a car advertised for a very low price, and it's a base model car, like the Nissan Altima S or whatever the model is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what models they have. I forgot, but a Nissan Altima. And they advertise it for a really seemingly very low price, something you've never seen before, even like an internet offer or anything like that. It's very low.
The code word is reasonable.
A lot of times what you'll see is a stock number associated with that. And that means they have one vehicle at that price. And that's for all of Southeast, you know, or North, Southeast Atlanta or whatever, you know, the region would be, you know, like all of West Texas or whatever.
How is that even legal?
They do that. And they advertise that one. But they might also say, we have five available for this price. And you have to get in there and get one of those five that are available for that. You know, otherwise, it doesn't apply to everyone. And they might have 20 other cars on the lot that are than Altima. But a higher trim level.
It feels like by the time you see that commercial, those five have already been purchased.
I think that's the way it is, really. I think that happens to a lot of people. They go in to get that one, and then they say, oh, you know what? That one was just sold, but let me show you this, the Altima ST or whatever. You know, again, I don't know if they have an ST or not, but they show you the one trim level package higher, and then they say, well, if you like that, then we've got this right here, and they take you to another, you know, aisle. And they've got five more of another one that's, you know, 10,000 more, 5,000
more. Just a little bit extra.
Yeah, and it's always just a little bit more, a little bit more. And that's the thing. My wife, this is good about this. She went in not wanting to spend a lot on a monthly payment, wanted a cheap lease payment.
Right.
And she stuck to her guns. She stuck to exactly what she wanted. And in that way, she got what she wanted. But
caveat
but
emptor,
man,
right?
was it just devoid of any kind of extras. I mean,
be careful,
it really
to
is.
For
it. I mean, it's nice looking.
Does it have a radio?
It does have a radio.
Did
it does
come
have
with
AC.
Tires?
Honestly, it's not a terrible. And that's the thing. I'm probably comparing this vehicle to. Maybe I'm not making a fair comparison, is what I'm saying. You know, because when you look at base models, as you said, from years past, they were completely devoid of anything. I mean, they had almost nothing in them. They were really, really just rattle traps. They were just nothing. Sparse vehicles, stripper cars is what they would call them because they're totally stripped of anything of value, really.
Right. Just an engine and the stuff to make the engine run and a place for the driver to sit.
Yeah, exactly right. And now, I mean, this thing is for that. You know, 5 years ago, this thing would be loaded, but now it's like it's got blank buttons and things like that. You know, where there should be features. So. Oh, that kind of leads us into this next quick thing that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Jalopnik had an article about four reasons why you should never, ever buy a base model car. And I was going to read through a bunch of these, but maybe I'll just read them off in order.
All right, yeah.
Number four, the base model is the cheapest car the company could possibly make. It's like they, you know, are hunting for every nickel and dime they can to save on the thing. So I think, as I said earlier, it's like the worst version of that model and that make of car that you can get. Why would you put yourself through that? That's one thing. And now, I know that there are instances where that's what you need to do. You need to get a cheap car. And a lot of times they'll point to small pickup trucks where that's the idea, is that you just want something to haul things. You don't care about AC. You don't care about power windows or all that stuff. You just want a vehicle that's capable of doing it. That's not the case with what we're talking about. The other thing, and this one might require some more explanation, but I don't know if we have time. You likely won't miss the extra money you'll spend on options. Now, that's a tough one to argue, but the way that he does it is he compares it to a mattress. The author here for Jalopnik, I think his name is Freddie Hernandez. Freddie took a lot of heat for this article, by the way, if you read the comments. If you read the comments for a lot of things, but he compares the money that you spend on extra options on your car, if it's new, to a mattress. And he says, here's why, because you spend a lot of time on your mattress, a lot of time sleeping, you want it to be the best mattress you can get, even if it's a few dollars more. Same thing with your car. If you're going to be commuting daily to and from work, and you're going to be in the car for hours, and then hours multiplied out by months and weeks, or weeks and months and years, becomes days, weeks, months in the car, spent in the car.
That's true. That's a good point.
You've got to be comfortable. And he says, why skimp on a few dollars if you're going to be in this thing for 10 years, commuting, feeling miserable about not spending an extra $200 at the factory or the dealer.
That's true.
10 years ago,
and that's a point that we heard raised in our episode on PI cars.
That's right. Yeah,
especially if you're spending a lot of time driving. Like,
yeah, the comfort level was critical for that person. I remember. Number two would be a base model is worth less at resale, and this one comes back in another article here, but. Later on, when you're going to sell that vehicle, a base model, like let's say you get the LX instead of the GT version, and it doesn't have power windows, it doesn't have it has a V6 instead of a V8. That stuff is going to come back to bite you later on when you're selling the vehicle. In some cases, that actually works for you. We'll talk about that too. But
like the ghost of dealerships past.
The last one, and I know I'm not explaining that well enough, but there's reasons for it. The article is actually does a good job of telling you. Dummy buttons and switches. Now, this is one that really bothers me. Mm-hmm. Whenever you get into a car and you see those blank plates, you know, where there should be an option or a feature that's not there,
mm-hmm.
for some reason that always bothers me. And I've had cars that have had a lot of those. I've had other ones that are fully loaded, you know, that I bought used, and none of those are in place. I'm trying to think of my current vehicle. I don't think I have any dummy switches right now or anything blocked out. Of course, it doesn't have certain features that a newer model would have.
Mm-hmm.
But for that model year, I think everything is there. I'm pretty sure. There's one area that kind of looks like dummy switches, but I think it's just an aesthetic thing. It's there for design to balance out the look. I've tried looking to see if there's an option that goes there, you know, like on other vehicles, and I've never seen one.
Have you ever seen I'm sure you've seen the novelty switches that people drop in
where
they've missed the option. So they say, okay, I'll put a switch that says ejector seat.
Yeah, smoke screen or something like that.
Yeah, right.
All right, so, you know, I hinted at, you know, the prices, and here's the thing. Auto Trader also did an article called Buying a Car, Should You Avoid a Base Model? And the answer, and this is a terrible answer initially, but I'll explain it. It depends. And that's a terrible answer, I understand. That's so wishy-washy. But they do explain what they mean. The idea is short-term versus long-term. And this is what I'll wrap up with here. How about that?
Okay.
Short-term, the general advice would be do not go the no-frills way. If you're going to buy a car short-term, you should just go ahead and get whatever option, whatever version you want if you're planning to sell it soon.
Right.
Which
seems
kind of strange, I guess. I mean, the idea is that you're going to have to sell it, and then with other people in the market with a car that has more options than you do,
it'll depreciate less.
Yes, that's right, because the other ones depreciate more, and then you also have to compete with the other people that are selling the lower end models and the higher end models, and you'll have to maybe, you know, compromise on your price a bit. So the resale thing is big on this. Now, if you're planning to keep your car long term, and I question this one.
Okay.
If you're planning on keeping your car a long time, like more than 6 or 7 years, getting a no-frills base model may not be such a bad idea, they say in this Auto Trader ad, or article rather.
Mm-hmm.
And they say you probably won't lose too much additional value when the time comes to sell relative to a seller who has a well-equipped car. And the reason behind that is if you're talking about something that's long-term like that, not immediate, where in the last example that I said the short-term was like maybe a year or two when you're going to sell it, or three.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, if you're 6 or 7 or 8 years out and you're going to sell it, most of the time what people are looking for is they're concerned about maintenance and economy, like fuel economy.
Right.
And, you know, the mileage. How good is it of mileage? Does it burn oil? Does it, you know, have you mm-hmm. maintained, you know, the brakes and all that? You
the
know,
actual core functions.
Exactly right. They're more concerned about the simplistic things, you know, if you can call it simplistic, I guess. You know, the overall running condition of the vehicle versus, you know, that it doesn't have the heated vibrating seats or something like that.
Well, there's a third thing.
What's
it
that?
Seems. A third thing would be the exclusivity of a certain package.
Well, that's true.
So I know that's a minority of car sales, but that goes into the realm of collecting.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, some people also say that if you have a car with fewer features, like a base model, that's less things to break.
That's
you know,
true.
Could it save you money on maintenance or would it cost you more money on maintenance? In that?
Well, like a sunroof is going to cost you money on maintenance.
Yeah.
If you own it for 7-8 years.
Yeah, that's true. I guess. Yeah, you're right. Cause, you know, the channels will maybe fill up with
right.
junk.
Gunk.
And then it'll leak into the car. And, you know, there can be problems with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I get it. The more features, the more frills, the more options you have, the more things can break.
It's more moving parts, man.
But then again, you know, like some people will even argue this. They'll say that, you know, if you got a car with a lot of stuff like that, there's going to be features and options that you never will learn or that will be very difficult for you to learn. But I say that's just part of the learning curve. You have to learn that stuff if you want to use it along the way.
Right.
That's not really, you know, something that you can't overcome by any means. I mean, you can learn how to do that or you can just ignore it. If you don't want the Bluetooth connectivity, you don't have to use the Bluetooth connectivity. You know, that's a thing. You don't have to use all that stuff if you don't choose to. It's right. maybe a waste if you buy it as a new option, you know, $1,500 option for like, you know, satellite navigation or something and you don't use it. That'd be kind of silly. But if you buy it, you should plan to use it. And then if you do use it, then it becomes of value to you.
Yeah, I completely agree. We've always, one thing we've always maintained on this show is that if it's your money, buy the car you want.
Yeah.
And as far as if it's better, I mean, the it depends thing is not the most satisfactory answer, but I think they explain it well when they say that this involves a confluence of several factors, right? Time owned, the type of car, the type of function you want it to perform. Is this your road trip car? Then if it's your road trip car, you might want to spring for a little bit extra in the seats, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. So this leads to maybe the last question that I have, really. And we're not going to explore this one too deep, but maybe just think about this one.
All right, I'm thinking.
Are these types of cars, these base model cars, going to go extinct eventually? Do you think that they're going to go to a system more like what you talked about, where they just sell one vehicle? You know, why offer that base model car? And the reason given in this Yahoo Autos article is that, you're not going to believe this, Ben. Maybe you will. The 7-year car loan might be a reason that the base models will go extinct. And the idea is that people can afford a lower monthly payment on a car that they finance for up to 7 years now. So they'll go for the better trim level, the higher trim level. Over the base model any day, because they don't want to take a 3-year car loan on a base model when they can have a 7-year car loan on the top end model and have their payment be just about the same.
That's a really good point.
Well, but man, financing a car for 7 years? I mean, I think that I read somewhere that Experian found that the average car loan is now 5.5 years.
Wow.
That's the average car loan is 5.5 years. So that's way out from where it was. It used to be that you could only get a car loan for 4 years.
Right.
Then they pushed it a little bit more and a little bit more. And now we're out to like more, 7 years.
A little further.
And I would bet that there's even more out there.
Oh, so, I can see it.
So manufacturers and dealers are selling a lot more high-end or loaded models than they ever were before, but they still have to bring people in with those base model cars.
I mean, there's psychology at play there as well, Scott. Listeners, you know this just as well as I do. Often it's easy for us as individuals to sign up a tomorrow version of ourselves for all sorts of obligations, because we're all these ideal versions of ourselves in the future, aren't we?
Well, I guess so.
We're all in a little bit better shape. We're all a little bit better off socially and financially.
Yeah.
We've done all those goals. We're committing, in effect, psychologically, we're committing someone else to an obligation.
Yeah, that's the way it works, I guess. And, you know, I just could not strap myself with a 7-year car loan. I know that it's some people, it's a necessity that they do that. Just they just at the time can't swing it.
Sure, yeah.
But man, I don't know. I can't see financing a car for that length of time. It would just be really, really difficult for me to stomach that. No, I'm just saying that I think we're going to approach the time where you're almost going to look at it like a house mortgage, you know, like where they're going to offer 15
or a student loan.
Yeah, they're going to offer 15-year options on these things, and that's crazy. I mean,
especially when you consider the depreciation of the vehicle.
Yeah.
Over time. At what point is it no longer feasible to have a loan of that length?
Well, I think we're already there. I think that it's 7 years we're past that point. So, all right. So that's a lot to think about there. I understand. And that was kind of a whirlwind tour of mine. And I wish I had more time to go over that Jalopnik article. And if you get a chance, you know, take a look at it. But 4 reasons why you should never, ever buy a base model car is the article. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to be entertained, go into the comments section, because he caught a lot of flack for that article when he wrote that, and wrote a lot of responses as well.
And so, how many different usernames did you make when you were in the comments?
No, it wasn't me at all. I just stumbled across this, but I thought it was an interesting question, and I hope it makes some people think.
And it goes back to what we were talking about at the top of that, the human element. It's your vehicle. What do you want? What are you using it for? And how many of those upgrades are cosmetic or aesthetic? How many are oriented toward you as a person? How many are oriented toward performance of the vehicle?
Yeah, absolutely. To each his own. I mean, if that's your thing, go for the base model. That's fine. But, you know, there are arguments for and against that just about every turn.
And here's the segue.
Okay.
No, literally, here in the studio is – no, I'm kidding. here is our segue into the mystery topic for you, my friend. This concerns racing. This concerns electric vehicles. This concerns the news. This concerns darn near everything but human beings. Recently announced, or recently revealed, the designs for the first electric autonomous race cars.
Oh, okay. Is this the
Robo race?
This is the Formula E thing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm looking at the picture of the car, and I gotta say that's a cool looking concept.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like that.
It's created. I've got some background for you here. This is created by a guy named Daniel Simon, who designed that flying pod in the Tom Cruise movie Oblivion. He also designed stuff for Tron, the new Tron.
Oh, I can see the influence in that here.
Yeah.
So this is it's called Robo Race, right? This is driverless racing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they go with this design, that might just be worth it to watch to see a bunch of these cars on
the track. That is the design.
Oh, that is the design. They're going to go with this.
Definite design.
Oh, that's pretty amazing.
Recently announced. It was in the idea for this was in the works for a while, but they hadn't published any photos.
Now, have we talked about this in the past? Only in passing, in that I think that I want to say that it was Rudy wrote in again and said, you know, if we're going to do this, if we're going to go full robo racing, if we're going to have, just all electric and no human element involved, not at all, why don't we go full destruction?
Yeah,
why don't
we
have a jam car go in the opposite direction? Why don't we, just somewhere in the middle plan for a pileup?
Yeah, the only human element that I can see in these vehicles, which look like stylized stuff you would see in anime, honestly. They look great. We'll post some pictures on Twitter if we haven't yet so you can check them out. But the only human elements are going to be in the actual assembly and engineering and design of the vehicles, which will all be identical in terms of their specs. Hmm. And the creation of programming, of algorithms.
Okay, maybe that answers my question.
That's the ultimate competition.
Well, okay, so the cleverness, the craftiness of the people that program these.
Yes.
That is where the benefit is going to be.
That's the real race.
That's the racer's edge right there, right?
Right.
I mean, so now when a racer sees a gap and they go for it, maybe the electric version won't do that because it senses that there's danger ahead, or will it be programmed to go for every gap that it sees? Will it be programmed more like an aggressive driver would be? I would guess that it'd have to, right?
That's the interesting part, right? The thing is, if we looked at these designs, what we see is that removing a human driver allows for some potentially brilliant engineering moves. Now we don't have to consider, we being the engineers and the designers, don't have to consider the placement of a human being in the vehicle. It means several things. It can be much lower. It can also we can also move batteries and motors, again, because these are electric vehicles, to the place that's best for the car's gravity, best for the tires. This thing now potentially can become a much better driver in some ways than a human driver, because reaction time may also change, right? Reaction time may evolve. The idea here is that these vehicles will have a top speed of around 186 miles per hour, which means it's faster than the Formula E electrics that are 140, and it's also faster than Audi's self-driving RS7, which
is
a little under 150.
Wow, that's a fast high speed, or a top speed rather.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I had not seen this design. This is amazing, really. I mean, if you look it up, Robo Race, you'll find the first design here.
It's supposed to come out with in this year or next year.
Okay. I would maybe consider watching this. I'm not a big fan of Formula E. I just
don't like
the electric race. I don't like the sound or whatever. But this is like a different twist on the whole thing.
I think
isn't this
different enough, because Formula E had something missing to me. Like, while I could intellectually appreciate the idea, it didn't get me excited. What I mean? But this is a little bit different. They're going to have 10 teams, each with two cars, and they're going to go on hour-long races in the same street circuits Formula E cars compete on. This replaces some other things, but one interesting thing here, one of those 10 teams will be a crowdsourced community team. So just people who are software and technology experts. And if you are listening to this show and you would like to be involved with that, then I would say write to Robo Racer, see what the scoop is.
Oh, absolutely. And I wonder if they're going to be have like a rotation, so you wouldn't be working on this the whole year long.
Mm-hmm.
You'd maybe work on one race. I don't know. I'm interested in how that would work, but how fun would that be to be involved in that? You know, if you had a talent like that for this type of vehicle or this type of programming,
mm-hmm.
that you could be a part of, I guess, I don't know if it'd be internationally recognized or just nationally recognized at this point, but that type of level of visibility, I suppose.
Right.
But I don't know if they're going to be aired on television or what. This is all so new. I don't really know a lot about this series.
Right. Still early days of development.
Yeah, really early days, but... Man, does it look cool. I mean, it's a fascinating design, and I mean, it looks like one of those cars, too, that, you know, they always bring out these concept vehicles that they have no intention of ever building. But
right.
If they can really build it this way, if that's the actual design they're going with, what a cool series to watch.
And what kind of maneuvers will these be capable of?
Yeah, are we going to be watching, like, a race where there's no passing at all? Is this going to be – because that's one of the critiques that F1 gets a lot, is that there's very little passing.
Right.
And other types of racing get that as well, you know, like the IROC series where – that's a little bit different, mm-hmm. but like the IROC series where they're so closely matched, the cars are, that it sometimes – not all the time, but sometimes it becomes almost a boring race in that there's not a lot of movement, not a lot of activity. The cars are so precisely matched that
yeah.
That it really takes, you know, the driver's skill in order to make them overcome that. So in this case, it would be whoever's programming them and,
mm-hmm.
and deciding, here's where I make my move every time. I try this every single time, or maybe we wait 10 laps and then we make our move in this spot on the track. But it has to rely on everything else that's happening too. Like, you have to know the situation.
Exactly.
And man, what a fascinating thing to think about. There's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, here's one. I'm just spitballing here, folks, but imagine this. So 10 teams, they each get two cars. What if it's a you know, right now these are like support teams, you know, or it's a support race. But what if there is a big race, all 20 cars out on the track, right? And maybe different variations in the software for each individual vehicle. But what if one team does a suicide move? This, Rudy, this goes kind of in line with what you were telling us earlier in that email, or proposing earlier in that email. What if the team with two cars, what if they have one of their cars purposefully wreck in a way that creates the most chaos amongst the other 18 vehicles and then leaves vehicle number 20 or vehicle number 19 or whatever, that's also on the same team, is the only thing with the programming to avoid this very specific sort of accident.
So
is that illegal yet?
Gaming the race is what they would be doing, right?
I mean, are you kidding? They're costing people millions of dollars. It's such a terrible move.
Well, that would be rough, wouldn't it? I mean, I guess any team could do that right now, really. I mean, you could cause mayhem on the track. You would be complete – I mean, you would – face the consequences.
I think you would be banned. I think especially
the driver would be hated forever. The
yeah.
team owner would be hated forever. If that was a strategy, if that was a plan of a racing team, they wouldn't last long. That's the thing.
No.
Now in this series, I would bet it'd be the same way, because you're right. They're probably – I mean, I'm going to guess it's $1 million car. It looks like $1 million car. I don't really
yeah.
know how much it costs, but just a ballpark somewhere around there. It's got to be. I guess you wouldn't have to pay. You wouldn't have to pay a healthy driver salary, you know, like they do now. Like, you know,
right.
guys they're paying $50 million to race in, you know, Formula One or whatever.
I'm wondering what would happen. You know. Like,
well, I don't know. That's a really interesting thought. I mean, I suppose they could block. They could, you know, they could work together in that way.
Right, as long as it wasn't causing wanton destruction.
Yeah, I suppose. You're almost talking about like, oh, you hang back and you hang back and then you take out the leader. And then everybody piles up behind them, but you know that's coming, so that the teammate car slows down and makes its way around and creeps around.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's how I used to play Risk. I used to take over Australia, so you still generate a couple armies every turn,
yeah.
and then just hold Thailand or Siam, as it's called in the game, and then wait till it gets down to maybe three people and make an offer surreptitiously to the other one, team up, and then betray them. Anyway, I guess I can't play Risk with anybody now if you listen to
your,
car stuff.
Your complete strategy's out there. It's out in public.
It's over. I'm going to have to make up something new.
That's funny, Ben. But, yeah, it's I guess that's kind of the way that we're talking about here, that they could work together on a team and do it that way. Now, I wonder if the 10 teams, two cars, means that they race 10 vehicles on the track at a time. You have a backup car, probably.
I think so. I don't think there's a situation where a team has both of their vehicles on the track at the same time.
It is an interesting thought, though.
It is an interesting thought. I would, if I were watching a film or fictionalized account of this, I would love for that kind of just morally reprehensible strategy to be in play once. But in real life, I don't think it's sporting.
Yeah, no, not at all. It would almost be like something out of a movie or something, you know,
exactly.
Where that happened. Yeah, that's an interesting thought, though. I mean, there's so many possibilities with this, really. I mean, you know, Rudy's angle of, you know, complete destruction and running just crazy races where
– I love it. It's so metal.
Yeah, it really is. It's a funny idea. You know, I think when we first talked about this, we weren't sure if they were going to have something where someone's actually controlling the vehicle from the pit
box. Right.
And it seems like that's not the case with these vehicles. It seems like it's going to be something that's just programmed and they just let it run the race and see what happens.
No, there'll probably be – I imagine there would still be a pit stop thing. It says, you know, their race times are going to be 1 hour, but I imagine there has to be something built in there to check programming or if the, you know, if there's a malfunction, tire pop, something like that.
Well, yeah, I guess that, but I mean, all that stuff can be monitored, of course. They'll know if they have a flat tire. They're going to know if they, they're low on batteries or whatever, but I would bet that 1 hour time is based on the battery, durability. You know, that's probably their full range. If I had to guess. I mean, that's typically how they limit these races. Although I think Formula E, they actually come in for a car change in the middle of a Formula E race. Do you know that?
Yeah, I had heard that.
Yeah, the driver hops out of the vehicle that they're currently in, hops into their backup car with a fresh battery, and then heads out. That's one of the reasons I don't like Formula E.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much of that is just the limitation of the battery technology?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. It just runs low, and then you got to get a fresh battery in. Rather than swapping out batteries on the track, they swap out cars in current Formula E. I don't know what they're going to do with this this robo race thing, but it sure looks cool.
Well, they're all base models.
Oh, yeah. I guess they would be, right?
Yeah.
They're all exactly the same. Well, I don't know if you can call them base models, though.
They're all – okay.
They're all the top-end models, really.
They're all the top-end models. Yeah. You're right. All the bells and whistles that are allowed are probably in use.
I would guess so, yeah.
Well, what do you think, listeners? Thanks for tuning into our mystery show. Scott, I think we did pretty well considering that both of us were kind of shooting from the hip on this one.
Yeah, we only knew half the show, really.
We only knew half the show. That's right.
Each of us knew half the show.
For our double feature.
Yeah.
Well, let us know what you think. Do you feel that there are some things manufacturers consider options that must be included when you buy a car?
Yeah, and what are your thoughts on this whole robo-race thing? I mean, is it going to pan out? Is it going to be something that people will really watch?
Are you going to watch it?
We'll go to see, or do you think that maybe it will remain a support race, you know, something that is just run along with another bigger form of racing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's interesting.
The jury's out, but we will learn pretty soon what's happening.
Also, just tell us what you think about these cars, too. I mean, the one that we're looking at is in The Verge, and again, it's just look up robo-race, and you'll see the
vehicle. Oh,
it's
got that blue and yellow paint job.
Very cool.
And I love the way that they I can't even talk about it too much. We're out of time. Check in and let us know what you think of these vehicles, the future of autonomous racing, and if you also have a story about bait or advice for other listeners about options to avoid or consider mandatory, let us know. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We've got pictures of Robo Racer that'll be up there shortly. And you can also write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.